This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending the 28th of March, 2025. Hello and welcome to the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper with extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle for the week ending the 28th of March, 2025. Reading for you today are Heather Thorpe-Tracy.
Hello.
Noel Thorpe-Tracy.
Hello.
And Jane Harding.
Hello.
And I'm a presenter, Keith Vincent, standing in for Steve Russell. The main headlines this week: Leisure Centre setback, Uni withdraws from plans for development. Regeneration scheme moves closer to a start. And disabled demand bus pass cut U-turn. So, Heather, may we have the first headline story, please?
Leisure Centre setback. The university withdraws some plans for the development. The derelict River Park Leisure Centre in Winchester is set to remain in a deteriorating condition after the collapse of a deal between Southampton University and the City Council. The university had been planning to demolish the 1980s building and redevelop the area as part of its School of Art campus. But in a surprise announcement, it has told the council that it is withdrawing from a development agreement. So in a shock announcement at a cabinet meeting on Thursday, council leader Martin Todd revealed that the university will be investing millions in its Winchester sites, which include the School of Art, but will not move forward with its plans for the former sports hub in Hyde. The news will stun many, including those who are unhappy that land set aside for recreation was to be taken over by a private university. The land on which the centre site was donated to the former runner of the City Council in the early 20th century, with the stipulation that it was used for public recreation. Other suggested uses for the site have included a lido and a public open space. Councillor Todd said, "We've had confirmation from the university of a planned investment upwards of £30 million to their premises in our city. But following their consideration of options, which took account of the overall economic environment for the university sector and for construction projects more generally, investment in River Park Leisure Centre was not part of the plan. Obviously, I'm disappointed, but I understand the reasons, and now we need to look to the future. So I've instructed officers to begin an open process of finding a new partner who can invest in the site, subject to three conditions. The green space, whether park, sports or play area, tennis courts or access through the site, is wholly out of scope. The public have a proper say during the process. Provision of the skate park and indoor bowling must be absolutely protected." The Friends of River Park are delighted by Councillor Todd's announcement regarding the agreement made over 3 years ago to devise plans for a student campus at River Park. The Friends said it had been a waste of 4 years since the leisure centre closed, when realistic plans could have been put forward by residents. Rose Burns, spokesperson for the Friends, said, "It is high time the redundant, increasingly derelict leisure centre building was demolished, perhaps to be replaced by grassland until a decision is made about the future of the site. We were told in February 2024 that the City Council had earmarked funds for its demolition."
Regeneration scheme moves closer to a start. The Central Winchester Regeneration Scheme, also known as Silver Hill, has taken another step closer to starting. The City Council Cabinet approved its developmental plan delivery plan along with a £4.5 million capital grant of Community Infrastructure Levy, CIL. The delivery plan has been produced by Jigsaw by Partnerships and Places, the Council's delivery partner, and sets out the project stages for the regeneration programme supported by the CIL investment. Councillor Martin Todd, council leader, said, "Central Winchester regeneration is a vital opportunity to bring new life to the heart of our city, new homes, new jobs, new businesses, and to do so in a way that's true to the city and true to today. It's a top priority for the council, and the decisions we've taken, are the last big step before we get to the planning application. The plan we've agreed lays out all the details of the delivery plan, infrastructure plan, public realm plan, and phasing plan needed for Jigsaw to move ahead. They've delivered to the demanding standards we set them. Jigsaw, by Partnerships and Places, is a partnership between Generate Kajima Regeneration Limited, Kajima and Generate Developments, and Igloo Regeneration with Thriving Investments, part of the Places for People group. The development delivery plan sets out how Jigsaw will design and deliver the scheme in accordance with the council's developmental brief, as specified in the formal development agreement. It also outlines how the Jigsaw team has spent the last year talking to local people and businesses from across the district to hear their views on the site. Matt Woolgar, Development Director at Partnership Places, said, "We are delighted to see the development delivery plan approved and this vital regeneration project moving forward. We are passionate about creating places that truly reflect the needs and aspirations of local communities, and the extensive engagement over the past year has been invaluable in shaping our approach. Today, together with our Jigsaw partners, working with Winchester City Council and the people of Winchester, we are committed to delivering a vibrant, sustainable and inclusive development. The Central Winchester Regeneration Project team has arranged a public information event about the scheme on Wednesday, April the 2nd, from 6 p.m. to 7:30 at the Guildhall."
Disabled demand bus pass cut U-turn. Disabled residents hit by the County Council's plan to cut their bus passes are set to hand-deliver letters to councillors asking for a U-turn. The controversial plans will remove all enhancements to the scheme in Hampshire due to the council's financial position and the forecasted budget gap. From April the 1st, disabled residents cannot use their passes before 9:30 a.m. or after 11 p.m. on weekdays. Those who cannot travel alone will also be stripped of their companion pass, which currently gives free travel to a volunteer who assists them. Opponents have said the cuts will damage the independence and well-being of thousands of disabled people who rely on buses to get to work, shops and medical appointments. They say the move will affect 17,884 disabled residents, but save only £73,000. Some £70,000 will be saved by cutting the additional hours and £3,000 by cancelling companion passes. Pensioners in areas with an infrequent bus service will also lose their right to use their older persons' passes between 9 a.m. and 9:30 a.m., saving the council £1,500. More than 1,700 people have signed a petition calling on Hampshire County Council to stop the cuts. Waterside Changemakers, a group that campaigns to help disadvantaged people, has invited the council's leader, Nick Adams-King, and its cabinet members to meet disabled residents. Patricia Clements, 58, who lost her sight in 2022, said the withdrawal of the pass before 9:30 a.m. will make it harder for her to visit the eye hospital and stay well by exercising. The former staff nurse from Marchwood uses her pass at 6:30 a.m. to go swimming in Southampton, helping her to keep fit when the pool is quieter. Mrs. Clements also needs to travel early in the morning because she has photophobia, a condition in which strong sunlight causes severe pain. She said Hampshire County Council had failed to inform her and other disabled people about its plans to withdraw their ability to use their bus passes before 9:30 a.m. In a letter to the council, she said, It's appalling that the council failed to give me and others a fair opportunity to explain how badly we will be affected by these cuts. Sight loss charities were also unaware of the council's consultation and the final decision. She said she would also be impacted by the council's decision to withdraw companion passes, which give free travel to a person assisting a disabled pass holder. And this is accompanied by a photograph of Patricia Clements at her bus stop, and she has her white stick with her because she is now blind, and she has her dark glasses and sun hat on to protect her from the sun, which gives her so much pain.
Thank you. That concludes the headlines. Now we continue with the death announcements, then Christian comment, letters to the editor, Chronicle comment, first person, and Belgarum. So we start with the death announcements this week. Barrett, Kevin John Barrett, on the 7th of March, aged 75. Booth, Antonia Booth, died peacefully at Winchester Hospice on the 10th of March, aged 87. Crockford, Edward Crockford, passed away suddenly on the 2nd of March, aged 81. Culhane, Deirdre Lena Culhane, died peacefully at home on the 21st of February, aged 84. Field, Mari Daphne Field, died peacefully on the 7th of March, aged 96. Hanson, Anne Hanson, nay Searles, died peacefully in Southampton Hospital on the 17th of March. Jones, Elizabeth Joy Jones, known as Jo, died at Tegfield House on the 8th of March, aged 89. And Simon, Ida May Simon, died peacefully at Mount Batten Hospice on the 3rd of March, aged 104. So, now we move on to Christian comment, please, Jane.
Which this week is Shameless Persistence. And it's from Nigel Hemming, the senior pastor at Winchester Vineyard Church. Jesus told a story once about a man who really needed his neighbour's help because unexpected guests arrived in the middle of the night and he had no bread to give them. In the story in Luke 11, the man thought nothing of banging loudly on the neighbour's door and waking up his family, demanding that the neighbour share his bread so the man could feed his guests. The neighbour was initially dismissive, but seeing that the man was not going to give up easily, he eventually relented and gave the man some bread just to make him stop. Sounds a bit far-fetched to our modern ears, but this story would really have resonated with Jesus' listeners. In their society, people travelled at night to avoid the heat and not show the requisite hospitality to guests was much more shameful than causing a scene by waking up the neighbours. The passage follows directly after the very well-known Lord's Prayer. Having taught his disciples what to say to God, Jesus is now focusing more on how to say it, urging them to ask and ask and ask again for the things they need. Jesus seems to suggest that outrageous persistence will virtually guarantee a favourable response. The man did not care what he looked like or what people thought of him. His goal was simply the bread he needed to feed his hungry friends. The key to the neighbour's response lies in verse 8. But I tell you this, though he won't do it for friendship's sake, if you keep knocking long enough, he will get up and give you whatever you need because of your shameless persistence. The man's actions are most definitely portrayed as rude and improper. Shameless could also be translated as impudence or insolence, but they clearly led to the breakthrough he needed. It's a striking metaphor for how we should approach God about the things that we really need. The Passion Translation puts the next couple of verses like this. So it is with your prayers. Ask and you will receive. Seek and you'll discover. Knock on heaven's door and it will one day open for you. Every persistent person will receive what he asks for. Every persistent seeker will discover what he needs, and everyone who knocks persistently will one day find an open door. Encouragement indeed. Pete Grieg describes a prayer as the power that unlocks the purposes of God, and one of the most important things we can do. So much more than simply bringing our requests to him. It is communing and communicating, using our lives and our free wills to agree with God's will. Life can be tough, but God is the God of hope. My experience has been that he is always worth spending time with, and like any great father, always ready to listen. Even when we are honest about the pain, struggle, and difficulty of life, he can meet us, be with us, and changes us.
Thank you, Jane. Now we move on to letters to the editor. Heather, please.
Deserve Better is the headline of Councillor Sally Yalden's letter. As readers may know, the Hampshire County elections scheduled for this May were cancelled at the request of local Labour and Conservative councillors. The government granted their wish, but can't even guarantee that areas like ours won't face a second consecutive year of postponed elections in May 2026 or even 2027. It raises serious concerns about accountability, leadership, mandate and representation. This decision coincides with plans for the sunlit uplands of what's called devolution and local government reorganisation, LGR. What are your thoughts on this? Most troubling is the lack of meaningful community engagement in this process, despite assurance and rhetoric that these changes are in the best interest of Hampshire and its people. Residents feel increasingly sidelined from decisions that will profoundly affect them. Meanwhile, electioneering for power and status to become Hampshire's new mayor in May 2026 has already begun. Installing a mayor who is likely commands only a third of voter support due to the flawed voting system of first past the post, while simultaneously undertaking an expensive and resource-draining local government reorganisation, creates a critical accountability gap precisely when democratic oversight is most essential. The emergence of petitions such as Save the New Forest and other calls of hands off Eastleigh and hands off Romsey in response to proposed mergers with Southampton demonstrates growing public discontent. Fundamentally, devolution and local government reorganisation distract from addressing urgent challenges like social care reform, an issue that remained unresolved throughout the previous Conservative government's 14-year tenure and continues to await meaningful action under the new Labour government. For devolution to succeed, decision-making can't remain confined to a small group of officials or councillors whose term in office was due to expire in May. And those same decision-makers can't keep finding excuses or requesting extensions to stop or delay our right to free elections. It's almost as if they rushed headlong with their request to join the fast-track programme, blind to the labyrinth of devolution and local government reorganisation happening at the same time. Public consultation on such a hugely significant change to local government has been effectively non-existent. Local government reorganisation was not in Labour's manifesto, so public consultation about it needs to be thorough, transparent, accessible, and above all, meaningful. In other words, if the public are strongly against what is being proposed, then the government and local decision makers must listen. Hampshire residents deserve better than decisions made about them without them. Councillor Sally Yalden, councillor at Test Valley Borough Council, Fernhill, Brashfield, Romsey.
And Eunice Stevens writes about a surprising view. I read Mr. Lever's letter with interest, Chronicle March the 20th. Others have commented on Dean Catherine's kindness and warmth, However, I find his suggestion that she has brought togetherness to Winchester Cathedral rather surprising. The review bears independent witness to a culture of secrecy, silo working, and totally reprehensible conduct, to which Dean Catherine and the chapter were unable to respond robustly. The sheer number of 46 recommendations is staggering. It beggars belief that they have not triggered more resignations. Bishop Mount Stephen states that the review highlighted some significant failings of leadership, management, and communications. That sounds more than a little alarming. The Anglican Church has marked its own homework for far too long, occasioning great harm. The interim dean has referred to a third party being approached to help address the recommendations. However, he does not clarify whether it is an ecclesiastical one or not. In my view, it is imperative that the Anglican Church seeks the assistance of secular experts in safeguarding performance management and guidance on acceptable norms of professional behaviour. Only then can proper processes be put into space, enabling it to move forward to the healthy and settled future for which Bishop Philip calls. Eunice Stevens, educational consultant, Cliffway, Compton.
And Ian Tate writes, Pavement Pain. Am I becoming a busybody? Last March, a car crashed into the wall behind Nat West in St George's Street, and Hampshire Chronicle covered the issue. The pavement was cordoned off when a scaffolding was erected. It's now been a year since the incident. So why is the scaffolding still there and the pavement remains closed? As far as I can tell, virtually no repair work has been done. So what is actually happening here? As someone who tries to walk everywhere, I am frustrated by having to risk life and limb walking in the road around the obstruction or, just as dangerous, cross St George's Street and then cross back. When I was a local councillor, it was this type of issue that I would try and resolve, but perhaps the ward councillors have more important things to deal with. And that was from Ian Tate, Romsey Road, Winchester.
Closure shock. I was quite shocked to learn of the demise of another independent shop, Cupboard of Health, in Parchment Street. It wasn't just a great shop. They also offered advice on remedies. Unlike France, England is a hostile environment for small independent shops. In Winchester, the rents and business rates are exorbitant. They're destroying the town. It's outrageous, writes EZ Mayor of Eastacre in Week Winchester.
And Barry Della writes that a link is not a new idea. Excuse me. I was intrigued to read that our former MP, Sir Ranald Jayawardena, is campaigning for a direct train link from Hampshire to Heathrow Airport, as if this is a new idea. It's not. The principle of a rail connection to Heathrow from the south has been the subject of considerable discussion and study for 50 years. It became known as AirTrack and would have provided direct links to the airport from Waterloo, Reading and Guildford, Hampshire. Hampshire would have had access to Woking and Staines. Work had been forecast to begin in 2011, but in 2010 the new coalition government undertook a spending review and the project never received funding. Throughout the time that Sir Ranulph was in government, this scheme was not progressed due to funding and other issues. I find it quite bizarre that now Sir Ranulph is no longer an MP, he's promoting a scheme that he was silent on when he was one. There is a major operational issue with the scheme on the matter of the 14 level crossings that the route would utilise, with the most severe problem being in Egham, where downtime at three town centre crossings would increase between 25 and 36%, for which there has never been an agreed solution. Perhaps Sir Ranulph has the answer to this problem, and the question of funding, given there is also a competing Western Rail access to Heathrow proposals serving Slough, Reading, Bristol and Cardiff with a much better business case. But even this project was cancelled by the previous Conservative government, of which he was part. Barry Della, Hook.
And Niall McAuliffe writes, Family Call. I'm looking to trace any family members of David Organ. David is the son of William and Mary Organ. William was from Dungarvan, County Waterford, Ireland, and his mother Mary was from Portlaw Village in County Waterford. David was born in Waterford City in 1901, and he died in the Winchester, Hampshire area on the 24th of the 12th, 1984, aged 83. David married a lady by the name of Irene Radwell, and together they had two daughters named Teresa Kathleen and Patricia Irene Organ. David was the third child to William and Mary. David's brother is named Thomas, and his two sisters are named Mary and Ellen. Ellen would become known as Little Nelly of Holy God. David's father was in the army in Waterford, and he transferred to Spike Island in Cork Harbour around 1905. David's mother died on the 7th of the 3rd of 1907, and his father died on the 25th of the 12th, 1943. I'm researching the family history with regard to doing it into a book or some other form of record. I'm looking to make contact with any of the family to get the information gathered in one place, and I'm looking for photographs or stories about the family. And that's from Niall McAuliffe, Cobb, County Cork, Ireland, email, should you have any information, cobbrebel@gmail.com, and that is spelt C-O-B-H-R-E-B-E-L, cobbrebel@gmail.com.
Tower Picks Call from Bill Hode. I am currently researching the Hermit's Tower, which stood on the medieval city walls between the West Gate and North Gate. It was demolished sometime around 1824, and the then current council sold off the walls and enclosed land, and new buildings were erected on the site. Amongst these were Tower House and a smaller Folly Tower in memory of the original, which have also subsequently been demolished. The first title delineation of the original Hermit's Tower appears in a vignette plan of Winchester contained in John Speed's map of Winchester, John Speed 1611. I am finding it very difficult to find contemporary drawings or photographs of any of these buildings. So if any of your readers have photographs, drawings or personal recollections of these buildings, please contact me on billthebook2000@yahoo.co.uk. That is Bill the Book, Bill is B-I-L-L, billthebook2000@yahoo.co.uk. Readers may think these personal recollections or any materials seem trivial, However great or small, it all adds up to a more composite picture of what happened. Bill Hode, Worthy Lane, Hyde, Winchester.
And David Morton asks, please remove tip booking system. Would Winchester Council please remove the booking system for the Winchester Refuse Waste and Recycling Centre, also known as the tip. I call it the dump. Anyway, the booking system serves no purpose anymore, and it is annoying when you want to use the facility at short notice and unnecessary overhead to maintain and support. David Morton, Fairfax Close, Winchester.
And Richard Atkinson writes, legal aid support. The 200th anniversary of the Law Society of England and Wales marks an occasion to celebrate, but also to reflect on the continued erosion of legal aid, our recent wins and the urgent need for sustainability. Legal aid seems as if it has always been a pillar of our justice system, but in reality it was born only 76 years ago. When the Legal Aid and Advice Act 1949 was introduced, 4 in 5 people were eligible for civil legal aid, enabling them to seek justice regardless of their financial means. By 1959, 10,000 solicitors worked in legal aid schemes, ensuring the profession's commitment to justice for all. Yet, decades of legal aid underfunding have reversed much of that progress. Since 1986, successive governments have chipped away at legal aid, drastically reducing the number of solicitors providing these services and the areas of law for which you can receive help. Millions were left unable to access justice. The numbers paint a bleak picture. In 2016, the number of legal aid providers had fallen by 37% compared to 2009. By 2018, at least one in three people lived in a legal aid desert with no providers to assist with housing issues. Since 2010, the number of civil legal aid cases has plummeted by 76%. This decline is not just a crisis for the legal sector, but a crisis for society itself. Legal aid is a public service that benefits us all, protects human rights, and even reduces the burden on other public services. In a recent Law Society YouGov poll, 89% of people said legal aid is important for those who cannot afford legal services. Yet, professionals who dedicate themselves to this work face declining pay and unsustainable workloads, driving many away from this area. Amidst this difficult reality, there have been some recent wins. The Law Society of England and Wales welcomed the government's recent commitment to increase civil legal aid fees for the first time in nearly 30 years. Under the new proposal, civil legal aid and rates will rise, and an additional £20 million per year will be invested in the legal aid section. This is a long overdue step in the right direction, and the Law Society has played a crucial role. But it is just that, a step. Years of underfunding mean that more investment is needed in more areas of legal aid to secure a truly sustainable future for this vital public service. The government must build on this momentum. The justice system needs further investment if it is to serve everyone, including those who cannot afford legal services. As we celebrate 200 years of the Law Society, we must honour our past by future-proofing a fairer justice system. Legal aid must be further supported to ensure legal professionals can continue to serve. The legal profession cannot stand idly by as justice becomes an inaccessible luxury. Our fight goes on until justice is truly available to all. And that was from Richard Atkinson, President of the Law Society of England and Wales in London.
Thank you. That concludes the letters. Now we move on to the editorial comment, please, Heather.
Editorial comment. Silver lining over River Park setback. What is it with Winchester and major projects? Both Silver Hill and Station Approach have suffered setback after setback and remain on drawing boards. Although plans will emerge soon for Silver Hill, also known as the Central Winchester Regeneration. Now we have the fiasco of River Park Leisure Centre and the time-wasting of Southampton University. It signed a deal several years ago with the City Council for the demolition of the centre and the expansion of the School of Art campus in Park Avenue. And now it's announced that while it is investing £30 million in its Winchester estate, the centre is no longer part of the plans. City Council leader Martin Todd was diplomatic in saying he was disappointed, which is a polite word for it. There are others. Several years have been wasted. But every cloud has a silver lining, and there was a widespread opposition to the university plans, which would have seen new public buildings and public open space effectively privatised, against the spirit, if not the letter, of the transfer of the land to the City Councillor's predecessor more than a century ago. Councillor Todd is calling for new proposals, so there is a chance again of a public debate on what should go there. People are calling for recreational new use, notably a Lido. There are similar ones in Petersfield and Lymington, and with the right management they can be successful. The tension is between what many people want to see and the desire to maximise the value of the land. This was one of the reasons for the collapse a decade ago of the plans for Silver Hill. Is the Chronicle alone in thinking, Wouldn't it be good if a lovely part of the city was enhanced with a development that pursues other goals?
Thank you, Heather. And now we have first person by Khalid Aziz, I think.
Yes, Khalid Aziz's headline is The Dogfather Saga Part 2. Well, it's happened, and all as predicted. Exactly 63 days after mating, our working Cocker Spaniel Darcy has presented us with a litter of puppies, now just over a week old. Unlike the last time we had puppies from a previous beloved pet, these pups arrived at a decent time, rather than the early hours normally favoured by mammals. In the run-up to the due date, the only outward signs were an initial swelling of her teats, a few weeks after her encounter with the sire, the redoubtable Todd. Then, not much, except a slight increase in her girth. From day 59, she started getting noticeably wider, and her behaviour changed. For a couple of weeks now, she has been particularly clingy, not straying far from us on walks, and showing precious little interest in pheasants nestling in the hedgerows. Our good friend, who originally gifted us Darcy from his bitch's litter, kindly lent us his whelping box, fashioned by his own hands from some stout plywood and what look like broom handles. Measuring 4 feet square and about 18 inches high, this box would be Darcy's and eventually her pup's home for the next couple of months. One of the biggest fears is that, especially when the pups are small, their mother can roll on them and crush them against the side of the box, with sometimes fatal results. The broom handles, slotted along the sides about 3 inches from the ground, help prevent this by giving the pups an escape lane, preventing squashing if mum does roll on them. We had been accustoming Darcy for a week before birth by feeding her in the box and getting her to sleep there too. With the due date almost upon us, Darcy was visibly widening by the day. How many pups were in there? We could have had her scanned after a few weeks of pregnancy, but we saw little point, as scans aren't always accurate. So we didn't bother. With 24 hours to go, Darcy's behaviour changed. She started vigorously scratching at the offcut of carpet that formed the base of the box. And then at just after 4 p.m, my wife heard a mewling from the utility room. The first pup had arrived. We found Darcy wide-eyed on one side of the box, and the puppy a couple of feet away, and scrabbling around blindly. They don't open their eyes until 2 weeks. No doubt trying to find mum. Within 3 hours, we had four more. They were sturdy, but not much to choose between them. They were all identical to their mum and dad, tricolour, black, with brown paws and eyebrows, and a flash of white on their chests. We still can't tell them apart. Within minutes, they were suckling well, and Darcy, although this was her first time, was instinctively a natural mother. We were checking them hourly, but next morning disaster struck. One pup had broken away and was lying marooned and still to one side of the box. Cold to the touch, we feared the worst, but we warmed her, and using a syringe trickled from some drops of milk into her mouth, within half an hour she rallied and could rejoin her mates. Another hour and we couldn't tell which had been the poorly one. Sadly, that didn't last. On visiting the vet, we were told about fading puppy syndrome. But carrying on doing exactly what you are, let's see. I had a feeling he wasn't hopeful. He was right. Within an hour of returning home, she was lifeless. The sadness in the Aziz household was palpable. We have since recovered and now revel in the remaining four pups, who are basically eating and sleeping machines. Plus the other thing. Piling on weight daily. Puppies attract everyone. And we are now already proudly showing off our new family.
Now we have Belgarum, please, Jane.
And Belgarum has two items this week. The first is Spiral spotted in the sky. And this has two photographs of a white... A round white spot, which I understand is not the moon, with a white spiral sort of swirling round it. And it says, a bright white spiral pattern spotted in the sky above North Baddesley was reportedly caused by excess fuel dumped during a SpaceX rocket launch. At 8 p.m. yesterday, March the 24th, Test Valley councillor Amanda Ford's boyfriend spotted the bright object, which she compared to a UFO. She said, "My boyfriend came back home and called me outside to view the clear night sky. There was a bright object above the house. It was remarkable and I was stunned. The object had a bright light round it whilst travelling across the night sky. It looked like something out of this world." The BBC has reported that the phenomenon is believed to have been caused by leftover fuel released by the rocket in space from a SpaceX launch. It is reported that the pattern came from a Falcon 9 rocket launched by Elon Musk's space company, which lifted off at around 1:50 p.m. local time in Florida on a classified US government mission. The Falcon 9 is a reusable rocket. After launching into space, it releases what is called its payload, whatever it is carrying, such as a satellite, to complete its mission, which continues its journey into space. The rocket then turns back around towards the Earth. As it does, it ejects any leftover fuel, which freezes instantly due to the altitude in a spiral pattern caused by the rocket's movement. Light is then reflected off the frozen fuel, making it visible on Earth, which explains these weird photographs of the round object with white swirling around it. And the second is very different. Brands bid to reduce salt and sugar. A Winchester-based ketchup brand has joined forces with a school food organisation to help caterers reduce salt and sugar in school meals. Real Good Ketchup, which is 100% natural and has no added sugar, has joined LACA, the school food people, to support caterers in meeting their salt and sugar reduction targets. The ketchup contains 80% less salt than regular sources, addressing both sugar and salt reduction while maintaining a taste that children will enjoy. LACA, established in 1990, is the leading professional body representing more than 1,000 members from across the school food sector. Real Good Ketchup is made in the UK using natural, plant-based ingredients. And this is accompanied by a photograph of Liz Jones, a very happy-looking lady who is the founder of Real Good Ketchup, and next to her two big boxes which contain the Real Good Ketchup she hopes the schools will use.
Thank you. Now we move on to announcements. We start with What's On. Two items. Friday, April the 4th, in Winchester Cathedral at 7:30 p.m, there's Verdi's Requiem, and that's performed by the Wainfleet Singers with the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra and four soloists. The whole performance is conducted by Andrew Lumsden. Tickets can be obtained from the Cathedral box office on 01962 857 275. The following day, on Saturday, April the 5th, something rather different, at the Theatre Royal Winchester at 7:30, it's The Furies, a legendary group of Irish music and song. They've been performing since the 1960s. Tickets are £20. Obtainable from the box office at the Theatre Royal on 01962 840 440. That's Saturday, April the 5th. Lighting Up Time ends Friday the 28th of March at 5:51 a.m. and begins at 6:31 p.m. And on Wednesday the 2nd of April, it ends at 6:40 a.m. and begins at 7:39 p.m. And you'll see the big change in the time. Just a reminder that, of course, on Saturday, the 29th of March, the clocks go forward 1 hour. Well, actually Sunday morning, don't they? But overnight, Saturday to Sunday, the clocks go forward 1 hour, so 1 hour is less sleep, or sleep in longer in the morning. And if you know someone who is sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings, or if you have a problem with the recording you've received from us, please contact us on 01962 861 229. And this number can also be found on the key fob attached to the memory stick. And now we continue with items of general news.
Ready when you are. Trees to return to destroyed woodland. And we're talking about Scory's Copse in Horton Heath. Ancient woodland that was illegally destroyed by a landowner more than 3 years ago will be home to trees once more. And there's a picture of trees in the distance and an absolutely derelict area in front with just dead branches lying around on bare soil. Trees have been replanted in Scory's Copse in Horton Heath to restore the area to its former glory. James Barney from Fair Oak was ordered to pay more than £65,000 after he tore through the area in April of 2021. Action was immediately taken by Eastleigh Borough Council, which stopped all works and prevented any further works without consent from being carried out. And now, more than 600 trees and whips, bare tree roots, have been planted in the place of those chopped down. The tree waste left at the site has been removed with the aim to improve the soil in the area. A total of 50 oak trees and 625 whips have been replanted. These trees are now subject to the Woodland Tree Preservation Order, TPO, that covers the site. Any works to the trees in the future would require the approval of the council. Cabinet Lead for the Environment, Councillor Robert Curl, said, "This was a long and difficult case for the council's planning and enforcement team, and it is to their great credit that it has now been successfully resolved. The judge fined the owner of the land £50,000, which secured Eastleigh Borough Council its ever-largest fine, as well as ordering him to pay costs. It sends out a clear message to landowners that we will vigorously pursue those who break environmental laws and protections that benefit all of us in the borough, including our precious wildlife, and the council will also make every effort to ensure that this affected environment is then restored."
And this is along the same lines. Volunteers celebrate planting more than 3,000 trees. And it's organised by Winchester Rotary. Volunteers planted 980 trees at Hinton Ampner alone. And there's a big picture of rather pleased with themselves Rotarians with an advertising poster for themselves. "A major tree planting initiative has seen more than 3,000 new trees take root thanks to community efforts. Organised by Winchester Rotary, volunteers planted 960 trees in Hinton Ampner alone on Wednesday, March the 12th, culminating in a total of more than 3,020 trees across Winchester since December the 20th. The group has said a huge thank you to all those who helped with the planting. It added, "There is definitely no way that we could have achieved these results without all your help." The last session of the season was held on March the 12th, due to the dormant season of bare root trees running from December to March. A team of 30 people took part, including staff from Simply Health and One Savings Bank, and a member of the Southampton Rotary Club, braving several weather fluctuations throughout the day. Winchester Rotary collaborated with the National Trust, with the latter ensuring the session ran smoothly, despite a brief issue with a locked car park delaying the start. The team successfully planted oak, silver birch and small-leaved lime trees as part of a wider effort at the estate.
And here we have new management is to be welcomed. "There is much to welcome in the Bishop's Review into Winchester Cathedral, speaking as one of a substantial group of more than 100 people, including old choristers, chorister parents, cathedral staff, members of the clergy, including foreman canons of the cathedral, numerous members of the congregation, and others that called for an independent inquiry after the unjust ouster of Dr. Andrew Lumsden. We wholeheartedly welcome the principal outcome, which is new clergy arranged management at the cathedral. Few have any doubt that Dean Catherine Ogle and the precentor Andy Trenier did many good things during their tenure. I know Dean Catherine is loved by many in Winchester, which will not change. While I'm glad Canon Rowley Ream also took a measure of responsibility for what happened, I know he has the full support of the Close for leading the cathedral through the interim period, building bridges and healing wounds. The review highlights the stress of COVID-19, but that does not excuse the inappropriate behaviour found both in the review and in 2021 with George Castle's grievance process. That this behaviour, or behaviour substantially similar, occurred a second time requires that resignations take place, which they have. While a portion of those actions were, in the words of the bishop, not taken maliciously or with ill intent, some were deliberate, with clear ill intent. This was not some accident or case of miscommunication. The review summary does not contradict our contention that Dr. Lumsden and other professional musicians were subjected to bullying and intolerable working conditions. Unfortunately, it is also light on specifics. It still does not answer the simple question of why Dr. Lumsden had to leave. We're also aware of several key cathedral employees to whom they did not speak, despite knowing of their direct evidence, which is deeply concerning on both a pastoral and factual level. We also take great issue with the review's vague criticism of the media and those external to the Close that helped give voice to the voiceless. The review fails to mention non-disclosure agreements or clauses, despite widespread knowledge and reporting that they were used. This is disingenuous, as the review mentioned that Dr. Lumsden has remained silent, without mentioning whether he was even at liberty to speak. The review also conflates individuals on social media, unspecified staff of the cathedral, members of the congregation, and oddly, those with a passion for cathedral music, accusing them of unspecified bad behaviour. We are well aware of a few social media postings that have been beyond the pale, largely from those uninformed or those with their own axes to grind from an absurd and archaic dislike of women priests, obscure points of liturgy and a gaunt, irrational things in between. The undeniable fact, however, is that the sole reason the review happened is because the mainstream media light was shone, piercing the culture of secrecy that the review criticised. The review admits internal processes failed. The press has behaved in an exemplary manner. Journalists must undergo legal review before their work is published to a level that would surprise most people. Neither the cathedral nor the review has disputed anything published in the mainstream papers or denied any specific allegation, even when given the right to reply. It is an untenable stretch of credulity that every single fact in the case was covered entirely by confidentiality. It is never bullying to stand up to a bully, and those in positions of a public trust cannot be shocked that they may be called out in the public domain for inappropriate behaviour and a culture of secrecy. That a full-blown whistleblowing investigation took place at the cathedral before Dr. Lumsden's departure with no significant change or resolution, yet the moment the situation is independently reviewed, senior management immediately resign, should say everything one needs to know about the internal processes that failed. This alone should confirm to any who were unsure, given the absence of facts in the public domain, that new leadership is needed. However, there is much time, much to be positive about at this time. New leadership is coming. We concur with the review that the cathedral is otherwise in good health, with many incredibly kind, decent people at its core. And this is inevitably accompanied by a beautiful photograph of the west arch of the cathedral with its wonderful window and the very long length of the cathedral, and three photographs of Dean Catherine Ogle, Bishop Philip Mount Stephen, and Interim Dean Dr. Rowley Ream.
Winchester is the best place to work in the United Kingdom, a new study has found. Research by Co-working Cafe found the city topped the list for jobs and work opportunities, driven by its strong employment market, high business density and competitive salaries. The findings highlight a shift in the work landscape, with mid-sized regional hubs outperforming major urban centres. Winchester boasts an employment rate of 87% among working-age residents, ranking fifth nationally. The city's job market saw a 12.8% growth over the past year, marking it as one of the fastest-growing employment hubs. And it also has the highest business density in Britain, with 177 businesses with 10 or more employees per 10,000 working-age residents, indicating a robust local economy. Winchester also emerged as the top spot for high-growth enterprises, with 7.4 businesses per 10,000 workers, recording at least a 20% employment growth over 3 years. The city maintains a steady job availability, with almost 90 job postings per 10,000 working-age residents. The median annual income in Winchester stands at £45,000. That's the third highest in the country. However, despite the strong earnings, housing affordability remains a challenge. Rents consume more than 36% of the median income, and the typical home price equates to more than 12 annual salaries.
County Council's first female chief to retire. Hampshire County Council's chief executive will step down later this year. Carolyn Williamson has announced plans to retire in July after more than 40 years' service in the public sector. She joined the County Council in 2010 and has held the post of chief executive for the last 4 years as the authority's first female chief executive. Excuse me. Her previous roles have included deputy chief executive, chief financial officer and director of corporate resources. Mrs. Williamson said, "I am incredibly proud of the work of the County Council and the exceptional and committed elected members and staff across the organisation who tirelessly serve Hampshire's 1.4 million residents. While I appreciate there's never an easy nor obvious time for a chief executive to make this announcement, this has been a wholly personal decision, one that I have been planning for several years, and now is the logical moment to step aside for me and for the organisation." And there's a smiling picture of her looking straight at the camera, obviously going to retire.
And here we have opera stars to sing for epilepsy charity. A special concert featuring world-renowned opera singers will raise money for the Meath Epilepsy Charity. The event, organised by opera singer Brindley Sherratt and his family, will take place at The Grange, Northington, on Sunday, June the 15th. The concert is particularly significant for the Sherratt family, as Brindley's daughter, Amy, has been a resident at the Meath since 2016. Amy, 34, has complex epilepsy, learning disabilities, and a rare metabolic disorder, which result in up to 10 seizures a day. She cannot be left alone due to the risks posed by her condition. Living at the Meath has given her the independence she craves while ensuring her safety. Amy said, "For me, the Meath means I have made good friends and I have a very busy week. Having so many seizures is hard, but I know I'm safe and my friends understand because they have problems too. I'm so excited about this concert at the Grange because I love the opera world and meeting Dad's friends, and I'm singing too." The event will be hosted by comedian, writer, actor, director and opera enthusiast Chris Addison. Brindley said, "I'm so grateful to all my friends who are yet again joining me. Our previous concert for the Meath at Glyndebourne was a huge success, raising substantial funds for the Meath, and we are aiming to emulate this success. I'm also grateful to the trustees of the Grange for hosting us in this wonderful venue." The singers will perform popular arias and ensemble from opera and musicals, and there will be a performance from the Meath Choir, made up of residents, including Amy, together with the Guildford and Godalming Jazz Choir. Lee Bennett, Chief Executive at the Meath, said, I'm personally thrilled that Amy's creativity and that of her peers at the Meath are at the heart of this prestigious concert. Amy and the Meath Choir cannot quite believe they will be taking up the stage at the Grange alongside 12 of the greatest opera singers of our time. And this has two little photos, one of the exquisite Grange building, which is so wonderful for operas, and the other is of the opera singer Brindley Sherratt in the most beautiful turquoise face, surrounded by flowers and dressed in incredible flowers. And that was on Sunday, June the 15th.
From one noise to another. Steam engines restored return. The SR Merchant Navy class locomotive is back. With a puff of steam, a shrill whistle and a rhythmic chug, the newly restored SR Merchant Navy class locomotive proved that even after 84 years, she can still turn heads. People gathered from far and wide to see the 35005 Canadian Pacific make its triumphant return to the rails on March the 19th. Crowds clamoured to climb the beautiful and meticulously restored steam to climb into the beautiful and meticulously restored steam engine giant, for which as it rolled into Alsford Station for a jaunt up the watercress line to Alton and back. A dedicated team of volunteers has been working for nearly 14 years to bring the engine back to life, and there were celebrations all around as dignitaries climbed on board to enjoy afternoon tea in the warm spring sunshine. Brian Carter, aged 73, from Fair Oak, has been involved with the project for 10 years. The retired engineer said, "I've always been interested in railways, and I got involved in rebuilding the Canadian Pacific when a friend suggested it to me. It's been really nice to know that all the hard work we put in has been worth it, and we're at the final day." Brian was part of the team that spent more than 10,000 hours renovating the Bulleid Merchant Navy class locomotive and two Bulleid carriages, 4211 and 1456. He said one of the hardest parts was putting 2,500 screws into the firebox, a tedious but very necessary job. Canadian Pacific was originally built in 1941 by a team which included many women working for Southern Railway at the Eastleigh Locomotive Works. Scores of volunteers and staff have combined efforts to restore the engine. It's taken years of work to get it back on the track and in steam. They stripped it, realigned the wheels, rebuilt the cladding, and carefully removed every part before carefully restoring and reassembling it. Alex Luckham from Waterlooville is a driver and part of the footplate crew. He's been involved on and off for the past 10 years. And the 32-year-old said, "The engine was very tired and it needed a lot of work, but it's very satisfying to see it finished." And there's a photograph of the CEO of the National Notary Heritage Fund, which helped this to happen, and a porter in his uniform, and behind them is the long, shiny, shiny locomotive with people on the platform and trees on the other side.
Dancing is the best form of medicine. A unique conscious dance party was held in Hampshire to raise awareness of the benefits of dance. The event, hosted by Dance for Life CEO and former GP Dr. Indica, was part of Angela Rippon's Let's Dance initiative. The initiative aims to highlight the positive impact of dance on physical and mental health, encouraging people of all ages and abilities to take part. The disco, which took place on Sunday, March the 2nd, in Medstead Village Hall near Alsford, was attended by around 60 people. Dr. Indica's dance party was unique, featuring live drumming and guidance to help participants find their rhythm. The attendees included individuals with medical conditions such as fibromyalgia and osteoarthritis, who were able to fully participate and enjoy the event. Parents danced with their children, and those who usually shy away from dance were able to let loose and enjoy the experience. The event created a strong sense of community, energy and fun. And there are three pictures of all sorts of people of age, all different ages, taking part in dance. And in one of them, there's a blurred image at the back of a token man who's standing there with his hands in his pockets. I don't think he's dancing.
And here we have village among best places to live in UK. A Hampshire village has been named among the best places to live by the Sunday Times. Broughton, which is just 10 minutes away from Stockbridge and tucked away in the Hampshire countryside, has been hailed by the national newspaper. Described as a little village with a big heart, the paper praised the area, which has an average house price of £758,000, for having a primary school, doctor's surgery, two pubs and a lively community store with a coffee shop. The Sunday Times said, "The best thing is the exceptional community spirit among the 1,000 or so residents who volunteer to run a packed social calendar of fetes, street parties and get-togethers, as well as putting on a huge variety of clubs." Kerry Lamb, 47, has lived in Broughton for 13 years and is the landlady of the Greyhound Inn. She said, "It's still got a lot of facilities people like to love about a village. We've got a pub, a shop, a school, a doctor's surgery and a sports club. People worked hard to make it this way and everybody used to have them." The landlady said the village's dedication to retaining its heritage and institutions was mixed with an openness to new people which has helped them survive. She said, "They appreciate they need new people to help keep things going. They're not like, oh, you've got to be here 20 years to earn your stripes." Molly Waldron, 18, who works at the Greyhound Inn, is a third-generation Broughton resident, and she said she loved it. "It's just the village. There's a community here, and I like it. Everyone's got everyone's back, and it's just beautiful here." The village has a good mix of residents from different backgrounds. It also has a serene quality, according to Callum Stevens. The 27-year-old said, "Well, it's quite quiet, and it's a close-knit community. I can walk in the pub one day and you'll hear what you've said to the only one other person. It's a nice place to live. There's no trouble and there's no real downfeel." And that's supplied with a photograph, inevitably, of three very happy-looking people from the Greyhound Inn, including the landlady, Kerry Lamb, standing behind their selection of beers, Thatcher's cider, I think that is, Estrella, Carlsberg and Gold. Looking forward to everybody coming in to enjoy them.
New move to rein in air pollution. A new strategy aimed at improving public health and tackling air pollution across the district was approved by Winchester City Council's Cabinet. The district-wide air quality strategy, which was developed in collaboration with councillors across political parties and other local partners and experts in public health, outlines a commitment to improving air quality faster than national targets. The strategy recognises that the impact on health, especially from small particulate matter, is not widely known but is significant. It also outlines the biggest pollutants in our district and focuses on what can be done to reduce these, working collaboratively and alongside experts across the region. It recognises the wide-ranging health issues that are caused by poor air quality, both indoor and outdoor, and describes areas of action to improve air quality and enhance the health and well-being of communities across the district. Winchester City Centre has been covered by an air quality management area since 2003, and since then a series of 5 yearly air quality action plans have been successfully driving improvements in air quality, a strategy that builds on lessons learned and looks across the whole of the district. There is a photograph, and we're in among houses, and there's a sort of screen on a pole. It's a rectangular screen on this pole, and there's a sort of thing hanging down from it. And it is one of the City Council's air quality monitoring stations. The city centre, partly because it's in a valley, is among the most polluted places in Hampshire, only rivalled by land near the M3 in the northeast. Speaking about the strategy, Cabinet Member for Place and the Local Plan, Councillor Jackie Porter, said, "Air quality, both indoor and outside, is a really important issue. Nobody wants to breathe polluted air. And for many of our residents, the health implications are serious, wide-ranging, although little known. Almost all of us, whether inside or out, are breathing in air which exceeds World Health Organization guidelines for pollutants. And we want to do all we can to drive down poor air quality and improve the health across the district, and at the same time share the small steps people can take to help protect themselves and their families. We've shown that action has improved air quality in the city. We want to extend this across the district, and we will work across the region to make that happen."
Primary school scraps Easter service and parade. A primary school has scrapped its annual Easter celebrations and service to respect diverse religious beliefs. The announcement by Norwood Primary School has sparked outrage and confusion among parents and carers. A letter was sent out by head teacher Stephanie Mander informing people of the decision to not hold the Easter Bonnet Parade or the Easter service this year. Ms. Mander said respect for diverse religious beliefs represented within the school was the reason behind the decision. "By not holding specific religious celebrations, we aim to create a more inclusive atmosphere that honours and respects the beliefs of all our children and their families," she said. The letter, which was shared in an Eastleigh Facebook group, was subject to much discussion. One person said, "I would have thought it best to celebrate everything, not nothing." Another commented, "I don't get it personally. It's an experience that's in walking distance of the school. Parents have always been given the option not to attend. The school's always been diverse and accepting of all." "But the school will celebrate Refugee Week in June," Miss Mander said, "as the school works towards becoming a school of sanctuary."
And here we have doggy detectorists to tackle digital crime. A new group of detection dogs will tackle digital crime across Hampshire and the Isle of Wight. As technology evolves, these specially trained dogs will play a crucial role in helping the police combat the ever-changing digital challenges. The dogs, known as digital detection dogs, will be deployed across Hampshire, the Isle of Wight and the Thames Valley. Their main task will be to uncover vital evidence against criminals who use technology to evade detection and hide their illegal activities. The group, comprising Evie, Iggy and Moss, is currently undergoing an intensive 8-week training course designed to equip them with the skills needed to detect a broad range of digital and media recording devices. They're joined by a 6-year-old, Lockie, which is renewing its license with a new handler after several years of service. Once their training is complete, they will join the team of seasoned professionals Dizzy and Ruby. These experienced dogs have already spent years sniffing out digital devices, playing a crucial role in solving serious crimes, including child exploitation, fraud, and stalking. Their superior sense of smell has been trained to detect an array of digital devices such as mobile phones, laptops, USB drives, SIM cards, crypto wallets, hard drives, spy cameras, and tracking devices. Detecting these devices quickly and efficiently is essential, as they are often used by criminals to store or transmit illegal content. And as the three lovely photos of the digital detection dogs, Evie, Moss and Iggy, I think they're spaniels and they're on leads and they have their noses ahead of them, definitely looking as if they can smell something which perhaps shouldn't be there.
Youngsters have their say. More than 20,000 young people have shared their views on issues that matter to them. The Be Well programme, and that's B with a double E, buzz, buzzy bee, seeks to improve young people's well-being based on their direct feedback, and has been working with Hampshire County Council, Southampton, Isle of Wight and Portsmouth councils to run annual surveys with young people across the region. The second and latest survey in the region was undertaken in autumn 2024 and completed by 20,348 Year 9 and 10 students across 89 schools, including 10 special schools. And that's, in old money, that's the third and fourth years of secondary school. This represents 47% of young people in these year groups across Hampshire and the Isle of Wight, Portsmouth and Southampton. The survey found that the number of young people reporting daily or recent vaping increases between years 9 and 10 from 4% to 7%. And young people reported experienced discrimination due to race, 24%, gender, 20%, disability, 15%, sexuality, 13%, and faith, 12%. Henry, a young person on the local Be Well Youth Steering Group, said, "The results of the survey reflect the clear issues that we face. It's especially clear in the levels of discrimination that the survey reports, and, of course, the rise in vaping in teenagers."
This sounds like fun. Revolting science show. A science show described as the most revolting is coming to Winchester. Rude Science Live will bring stinky, messy fun to the Theatre Royal Winchester on Sunday, April the 6th. The show promises to feature unusual experiments such as snot cocktails and pee-powered fireworks with the aim of exciting young audiences. Described as outrageous, all experiments align with the school curriculum to make learning enjoyable. Rude Science Live was created by Stephen Gates, a TV presenter known for his work in the CBBC series Gastronauts and Incredible Edibles and author of Fartology. The show will cover complex biology, physics and chemistry topics in an entertaining manner, led by the presenter's vast science knowledge. Youngsters can expect fun with large whoopee cushions, and there will also be interactive moments with earwax oozing mannequins and a fart machine. The show will be on stage at 11:30 a.m. and 3 p.m. After each performance, audiences will have the opportunity to meet and greet Gates. The organisers have cautioned audiences to expect particular smells, explosions, stage smoke and latex balloons. Rude Science Live caters to the 5 to 14 age group, but younger viewers are welcome with caution for sensory stimulation.
And students host Family Fun Day. A performing arts school held its first Family Fun Day. Rhynan Performing Arts and Swan Samba hosted the event at Swanmore College on March the 23rd from 10 to 12 p.m. The event was the first of its kind and aimed to showcase the benefits of dance, drumming and movement for well-being. It also highlighted the skills of students of all ages and abilities and encouraged public participation. The day was opened by the Mayor of Winchester, Councillor Russell Gordon-Smith, and featured a samba drumming display, dance workshops, performances, guest appearances, activities and face painting. Councillor Gordon-Smith said, "I'm stunned by what I've seen here today. I have heard the samba band play and seen the dancers perform. Plus, I have watched a girl who was singing beautifully. It is great. Places like this give youngsters the confidence they need, help them socialise and get them active. They learn so much. It is brilliant." Established in 2010, Rhynan Performing Arts supports and nurtures all ages and abilities in dance, music and drama. The school runs various dance and performance classes at Swanmore College throughout the week. It is also home to the Swan Samba, a samba fusion drumming and movement band for people aged 11 and over. Swan Samba regularly performs at events across the South. Sarah Munday, dance school principal, said, "It has been lovely to get the community together and to let them see what the dance school is doing and what we could get up here in our lessons and also to share the joy of dancing and singing. It has been lovely to see everyone's smiling faces. And there is a beautiful photograph of mixed ages, girls and boys, all in their the right appropriate dress, and some of them with bare feet and some of them with simple ballet shoes, and they're all dancing and having a wonderful time together.
Chocolate, not clothes, at a shop. A new chocolate-themed cafe is set to open on Winchester High Street, in the shop where clothing shop Hobbs once traded. British brand Hotel Chocolat has submitted a planning application to the City Council to put up the black and orange signage for a Velvetizer cafe. Hobbs left the site, which was next to the recently closed Halifax branch, in October. Hotel Chocolat's arrival on the High Street will be the latest addition to the city's swelling multitude of cafes. Some residents have complained that there are now too many, particularly in the aftermath of the closure of several independent city centre businesses, such as Earthian and Cupboard of Health, both in Parchment Street. In a recent editorial, the Chronicle took a diplomatic view of the recent developments on the High Street. One thing that does need to be stated is that no one is to blame. Many people wrongly think that the City Council has a say over which businesses move in. It doesn't. The market decides. If anyone wants to wrest control from the capitalist free market, then they need to elect an extreme left-wing government, which doesn't look very likely. However, the City Council has certainly got questions to answer over the deterioration of the two properties it owns down on the Broadway. They are now up for sale after standing empty for around 20 years. Years of rental income has been lost.
Mass Ride hits the streets. Cycle Winchester will be holding its next Mass Ride in April. The event will take place on the morning of April 26th. Following the planned ride in September being postponed. Cycle Winchester has said it wants the ride in April, Mass Ride 8, to be bigger, better, safer and even more enjoyable. A note on the group's website said, Mass Ride 7 was such a huge success, with over 400 riders filling the streets with cycle joy, that we were asked to look at ways to reduce the potential conflict between motorists and bikes. We are pleased to say we've recently gained agreement from the authorities to hold back cars very briefly at key junctions in the city centre so that the mass of cycles can pass as one sausage. This won't be a full road closure. We will still coexist with cars, but we'll all be part of a bigger protective peloton. Mass Ride 8. We'll have multiple start locations around the city from 10 a.m. converging on the system at approximately 10:30 a.m. for a lap of Winchester, finishing with a gathering at Abbey Gardens from 11 a.m. To promote the ride, Cycle Winchester is preparing 5 yellow bikes, which will be placed on parts of the cycle route over the next few weeks. Each week, the bikes will be placed further on the route and will eventually become public awareness bikes, with Cycle Winchester inviting members of the public to vote to have them placed at points of poor cycling infrastructure or good cycling infrastructure. So, look out.
And here we have Genealogical Society delves into suffrage. A historian has delved into the legacy of a woman who led a suffrage march from Edinburgh to London. Florence de Fontblanc, born in 1864, was a French immigrant and a Huguenot who spearheaded the march in 1912, aiming to gather support for women's suffrage. Emma Cox, a genealogist and historian, recounted Florence's determination at a recent meeting of the Winchester Group of the Hampshire Genealogical Society, revealing how, at the age of 43, she embarked on a media campaign to rally support for the march in September 1912. The Women's March was self-funded, with participants wearing a uniform that could either be purchased or homemade. However, each marcher was required to donate £50 to join. The campaigners, who were known as the Brown Women, were accompanied by a horse and carriage carrying a mass of signatures supporting the cause. The group followed the route of the A1, holding meetings in towns along the way. Florence even climbed a telegraph pole to collect signatures. Despite their efforts, the then Prime Minister, Mr. Asquith, refused to receive the petition at 10 Downing Street. This refusal, however, generated substantial press coverage, and the petition was eventually delivered on November the 16th, 1912.
Courts still hit by lack of resources. Winchester Crown Court is operating at a limited capacity, in spite of the huge backlog of cases faced by courtrooms across the country. Since the beginning of the new year, the law courts have frequently stood empty, with only two of them operating through much of February. In September 2024, the number of unheard Crown Court cases reached a record high of 73,105. It is unclear how many cases are currently outstanding, as this figure is published yearly. Leader of the Western Circuit, Joe Martin, KC, has pointed to underfunding as a key issue, which she claimed has made the current situation inevitable. She said, "Seeing empty courtrooms in Winchester and nationally is soul-destroying for all who work in or come into contact with the criminal justice system. Everyone wants to get the backlog down, to significantly reduce waiting times for trials, but the lack of resourcing over many years at all levels of the criminal justice system has created the inevitable situation we're in today. I very much hope that the two out of the seven courts sitting in Winchester today will be at least six out of seven come April the 1st, when the new sitting day protocol comes into effect. The resourcing and staffing of those courts isn't just about judges, but also clerks, ushers, security, admin staff, as well as barristers and solicitors. Every part of the system needs considerable tender loving care to get the empty courts in full flow again." A spokesperson said, "The government inherited a justice system in crisis, with a record and rising Crown Court backlog which delays and denies justice to far too many victims. And while we're bound by our financial inheritance, this government is committed to bearing down on the Crown Court backlog. We have already founded an additional 2,500 sitting days, rising court capacity to the highest in almost 10 years, and we are committed to working with our partners to deliver longer-term reform."
The King gives a choir a castle surprise, and there's a picture of the Wessex Chamber Choir standing together on the steps to St George's Chapel at Windsor, looking very pleased with themselves. A Hampshire choir had a surprise royal encounter while singing at Winchester Castle. The Wessex Chamber Choir, based in Hook, was recently at St George's Chapel, Windsor Castle, to sing in place of the regular choir, who were on a break for half term. The choir, under the direction of Oliver Tarney from Winchester, was well rehearsed and prepared for the service. However, just before the service began, the unexpected news arrived that the King would be in attendance. The choir had been well prepared and had practiced over the weekend with the chapel's organist, Peter Gould. The King, walking through the chapel, took time to speak with choir members. At the end of the service, the national anthem was sung, and some members in the congregation were bemused to see the King, who had slipped in unnoticed at the beginning. The King heard two of his favourite pieces by composers Sir Charles Villiers Stamford. And it's, as I said, a big picture of the choir standing on the steps there.
And restaurant reintroduces Eat Out to Help Out. Eat Out to Help Out has made a return as one restaurant chain aims to bring people back. The promotion, which follows the Eat Out to Help Out, or EOTHO, government scheme in 2021, will be in effect in Winchester's Dim Tea restaurant, as well as others in the UK. Wildwood will also be part of the promotion. The restaurants run by Tasty PLC are taking a stand to make dining out affordable again with the scheme, which will be self-funded. The reintroduction of EOTHO in April will coincide with the increases in employment's national insurance contributions and rise in the minimum wage. In recent years, the food industry has faced an unprecedented series of challenges, from Brexit, which disrupted the primary labour sources and supply chains, to the COVID-19 pandemic, which led to widespread closures, and the war in Ukraine, which drove up wheat and energy prices. Restaurants across the UK have been under immense pressure. More than 400 pubs closed across England and Wales in 2024 alone, and many more restaurants have suffered the same fate. CEO of Tasty PLC, Johnny Plant, said, "We know that families are feeling the pinch and dining out just isn't as affordable as it once was. That's why we are stepping up and bringing back EOTHO, entirely funded by us. We are committed to making dining out a more accessible experience for everyone."
Thank you. That concludes the extracts for this week. Just before we close, I would say that on Wednesday the 16th of April at the Victoria Hall, Sutton Scotney, between 9:30 and 12 o'clock, there is a community coffee morning, and they have very kindly offered to support Winchester Talking Newspaper as a charity at that event. So if anybody wants to pop along to Sutton Scotney, the Victoria Hall, Wednesday the 16th of April, between 9:30 and 12 o'clock, for delightful coffee and cake.
Serve good cake there.
It is good cake. It is good cake.
I don't need to write anything down.
So, thank you to our editors for selecting the extracts this week, and to the copying and memory stick preparation teams. And thanks, of course, to our readers, Heather Thorpe Tracy.
Goodbye.
Noel Thorpe Tracy.
Goodbye.
And Jane Harling.
Goodbye.
And from me, Keith Vincent, goodbye, and do have an enjoyable week. And when you finish with this week's recording, please put the memory stick back in the wallet and return it as soon as possible, placing the address label inside the wallet. Thank you.